This is Law and Disorder. Today on Law and Disorder, you'll hear the voices of the Immokalee workers. They're protesting in front of Trader Joe's. What do they want? A penny a pound. More for a tomato.
We'll learn about a disturbing partnership between Wall Street firms and the New York Police Department.
If you didn't know they worked together before, you'll know it after this segment. Together, in a room against occupied Wall Street, they monitor 3,000 surveillance cameras looking at everything we do and say.
Stay with us.
City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Mic check.
Well, here we are, three lawyers, to talk to you a bit about some updates on Occupied Wall Street. The first thing we want to do is give you some information about what to do for your rights and if you're arrested. And we have Heidi here, who's the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild. She's going to give you the website, which lists not one, not 10, not 20, but 75 cities where the Guild has a presence and more, where you can call if you get in any trouble with the cops, with your occupied territory, etc. Heidi, why don't you give people the website?
Well, the National Lawyers Guild website is www.nlg.org. You can check for a contact person in your local jurisdiction if that's posted on the site, or just give us a call. The number's on the website, 212-679-5100, and we'll find a Guild attorney in your area. And if there isn't one in your area, we'll make every effort to match you up either with an ACLU attorney or another progressive lawyer.
Say the number again, Heidi.
212-679-5100.
That's www.nlg.org.
The Guild has been everywhere. There's a list, as I said, of 75 cities or towns where you can go to. So, again, thank you, National Lawyers Guild. We are there for Occupied Wall Street. There are a few updates about some victories. Of course, I think all of us were at the park a couple of weeks ago when Bloomberg said he was going to evict people. Thousands of people came down to the park and prevented that eviction. But amazingly, this is going on across the country now. People are coming out, and there's even occasional court victories or otherwise. So recently, we heard that Governor Cuomo of New York wanted to evict people from whatever it's called in.
It's right in front of the state capitol.
It's the main square for protest in front of the state capitol. He tried to get people arrested there. He tried to get the police to act. The district attorney said, you can arrest the people, but I'm not going to prosecute them. So the people are still there in front of...
It's the state capitol. I drove by. There are a couple hundred tents. It's right between the city hall and the state capitol in the main downtown Albany.
We applaud the local authorities for not succumbing to the governor's pressure. This is the kind of thing that we'd like to see happen all around
governor
the country.
Governor and the mayor.
I mean, the governor and the mayor wanted to arrest the people in Albany. The district attorney, Soares, I think is his name, Soares, said that I'm not doing it. I'm not going to prosecute.
In fact, I heard that the fire personnel came by with coffee and donuts for the protesters.
That's right.
Yeah.
Occupied Wall Street, as I'm sure most of our listeners know, has tremendous support in the country. It's probably over 60% all across the country. I was in Cleveland last week, and I, of course, visited Occupied Cleveland. It was typical Cleveland weather because I was raised there.
Cold and rainy, dark, depressing.
Exactly.
Low gray ceiling.
I mean, I felt I was like on some boat in the North Sea or something. But anyway, I went there, and they were all in public square, sitting on a statue of Moses Cleveland, the founder of my hometown, Cleveland. There were only a scattering of people, I mean 30 or 40, but there were signs and everything. And I didn't know anything about the occupation of Cleveland at that point. But they said the night before, you know, a couple of dozen people had been arrested by the Cleveland cops. And friends of mine are representing them, et cetera. Then I go and give a lecture at Cleveland Law School. And a guy comes up to me who is a federal judge, who I knew from when I was a kid. And he says, Michael, I just was able to settle the Occupied Cleveland. There was a lawsuit brought, and I went in there and I basically said, we're not busting heads in this. What we're doing is we are going to lift the curfew on that park. And while people can't sleep there, they can stay there all night. So here you have a federal
Fabulous.
Judge saying,
yeah.
That's it. They can stay all night.
That's great.
So I went back to Occupied Wall Street, and of course, people told me that story and were completely enthusiastic. So you can add Cleveland to Albany, probably other places.
You just reminded me there's a town somewhere, and I can't remember where, but the local librarians opened up the library yard for the protesters because I guess they were kicked out of the town square or wherever. And that's the kind of support that we hope will catch on, creative ways of accommodating the protesters.
No, it's happening all over the country. Another victory was had a few days ago in Nashville, Tennessee. The judge calling the place the people were occupying as the key public forum in Nashville. And the ACLU brought a lawsuit. You can go to the ACLU site and find the lawsuit. And the judge, in a ringing First Amendment case, said you cannot impose a curfew on this park in Nashville. So now the people in Nashville remain there. And, of course, Oakland, we're all familiar with most of the elements of that story. But if you want to see something amazing, it's watching the mayor of Oakland apologize for the tear gas that she basically authorized being used and the injuries that were caused.
In violation, we might add, of their own crowd control policies that were adopted after litigation that arose out of use of less lethal munitions in 2003 against the dock workers there. Yeah. So they violated their own policy.
Yeah, well, she backed up in a hell of a hurry. Citizens of Oakland are calling for a work stoppage, general strike. I don't know what it's going to unfold. And last week, there was a call for a general strike, work stoppage. Thing has unfolded in a very positive direction.
Which the longshoremen supported, I should say, in Oakland.
Are longshoremen the same as stevedores?
Well, okay. They were the most powerful union on the West Coast, and they got automated. But they're still very powerful.
And they're very active.
So Oakland's a good example of how people power can change history. Just a really good example. And my favorite little part about it was, of course, that the mayor came to speak at Occupied Oakland, and they refused to let her talk, which is exactly what they should have done.
Right.
There's some kind of mistakes you don't make.
That's right.
Now, that's the good part. Of course, we've had our negatives. There's been repeated arrests at Occupied Denver, repeated arrests as we speak about this that may be happening in Arizona and other places. So it's going back and forth. But I would say that when this started, not only, of course, I think none of us could have predicted how it would take off, but I don't think we could have predicted the vigorousness with which the First Amendment, at least in many cases, is being enforced.
And you know, Michael, I know you've said, both of you, Michaels, have said, if you don't use your First Amendment rights, you lose them. That's sort of been a subtext of a lot of our conversations since we began airing Law and Disorder.
After 9/11, the policies and practices that they put in on paper made this place look like an utter police state. And we've been saying since then, the only way to get that reversed is not through Congress, but out on the streets. And that's what's happening
now. And what I think we can celebrate this and hope that it keeps spreading.
And then here in New York, of course, we beat the cops back before. There's been continuous back and forth harassment, taking the generators. Now you see how Occupied Wall Street has recovered from that by using bicycles to generate electricity. And last week, my daughter came down from Bard College with these huge bread and puppets, scores of them, walked to Occupied Wall Street, gathered people up, and were in the Halloween parade. The huge puppets were called Fatso, the 1%, and then there were little puppets on sticks that were called the 99%, and there were literally 40 shopping carts distributing the Occupied Wall Street Journal. So it was a great day at the Halloween parade for the puppets and Occupied Wall Street.
Even today, when I was walking from my apartment along Wall Street to get over to BAI, which is on one end of Wall Street, I live way over in the other, there were a couple of tourists, young girls from the South, and one said, "Oh my God, it's Tiffany's." And the other said, "And there's the stock exchange where all the wheels and deals are made." And just as they were saying that, a huge crowd of young people, black, white, Latino, men, women, were marching towards me, all carrying brooms, push brooms and sweep brooms.
That's great.
Screaming, "Clean up Wall Street, clean up Wall Street." So you wonder what those tourists were thinking.
We picked up a lot of tourists, Michael, on the way up to the Halloween Day parade. When we were carrying the puppets, they asked what's going on, and they followed us, and a number of French tourists in particular wound up carrying puppets in the parade.
Yeah.
I wanted to mention something that people may not be aware of, and that is the fact that active duty GIs, reservists, and veterans taking part in Occupy actions actually face kind of strict rules, things like other than honorable discharges for participating in legal street theater protest actions. Some commands have even gone as far as to illegally confine entire units to base. So with that in mind, I just wanted to let people know that the Guild's Military Law Task Force has released new Know Your Rights material specifically aimed at military members who want to participate in Occupy Wall Street
protests. Goes all the way back to the Vietnam War.
Right.
And soldiers were forbidden to demonstrate, and that rule was changed. The rule now is you can demonstrate, you just can't demonstrate in uniform. But they've got a First Amendment right to be out there with us.
I do want to answer one question we received from a listener. The listener asked the question about whether President Obama or Nobel Prize winner President Obama has acted in conformance with his oath to obey the U.S. Constitution. Now, I think we've been very clear on it, but apparently this listener wasn't so sure, and he particularly mentions the killing of Omar al-Awlaki.
Right.
And that's clearly a constitutional violation. Al-Awlaki was protected both by the U.S. Constitution, the Fifth Amendment due process clause of the Constitution. He was entitled to due process, which really means going to court to get some kind of arrest warrant and then try and arrest him, not to murder him. And under international law, he violated the international laws of war. So let's be clear here. President Obama has this, in this respect, as well as many others, we can just tick them off, a war in Libya, everywhere else we can talk about, Guantanamo, has violated his oath of office, has violated the Constitution. Let's just be 100% clear.
And international law.
And international law as well.
I mean, targeted killings are basically assassinations.
That's right. Targeted killings are assassination.
Assassination differs from murder in that it's a political murder. They assassinated al-Awlaki, and then the week later they killed his son, a 16-year-old.
Michael, we have an interesting development coming out of Olympia, Washington, and it regards a food co-op where members of the food co-op boycotted Israeli goods.
Well, we brought you a segment on this before. It's part of the BDS movement, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanction movement, and the Olympia Food Co-op voted to boycott certain Israeli products and no longer put them on their shelves. It was democratically decided to do so, but apparently some disgruntled members felt that they didn't like it, and they are suing individual members of the Olympia Food Co-op, claiming that somehow their fiduciary rights or some laws under Olympia, Washington, were somehow violated in that. Well, interestingly, Washington, like a number of other states, has what are called anti-SLAPP lawsuit statutes. And what they do is they say that a person who brings a lawsuit like was brought against the people at Olympia, Washington, has to demonstrate that it's not done to intimidate or push back or in some way violate their First Amendment rights. So what we did at the center was we said, well, this lawsuit was really an effort to stifle First Amendment rights of that co-op, the Olympia co-op. And last week we filed a lawsuit, or really a response to the lawsuit, saying that this was basically an effort to stifle First Amendment rights, that this was a strategic litigation against public participation. That's what the word SLAPP lawsuit comes from. We claimed it was a SLAPP lawsuit to discourage First Amendment rights, and we have filed a lawsuit to stop it.
And if this motion to strike the suit is successful under the Washington State anti-SLAPP statute, the plaintiffs have to pay attorney's fees, related costs, and a $10,000 penalty for each defendant involved.
Right.
So that's a pretty strong statute.
The plaintiffs are the bad guys here. They're
right.
The people who don't
right.
want the BDS, who sued Olympia Washington Food Co-op. If we win this lawsuit, they will be required to pay damages to the defendants who the center and other attorneys are representing.
And, Michael, I want to note that the Olympia Food Co-op was founded in 1976, and like many other food co-ops, its purpose is to provide good food, make it accessible to more people, but they also encourage economic and social justice and have a long history of doing social justice work. So this is in line with their mission.
Right. This wasn't just the first time they decided to do something. They boycotted many different things along the way and had much social protest. We should also remind our listeners that Olympia, Washington is the home of the Corey family. Rachel Corey was from Olympia, Washington, along with another person who I've had who I've helped represent was Chaplain Yee, who was the only Muslim chaplain at Guantanamo They charged him with espionage, kicked him out of Guantanamo, a BS case completely.
Right.
So Olympia has some radical
roots.
So this lawsuit is a real effort at undercutting really the rights of the members of the co-op to decide what they're going to buy, what their social mission is, and what they're going to eat.
Let me just add that Free Radio Olympia 98.5 FM is one of the stations that gets Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Olympia, Washington, and we will win. For many years now, tomato pickers in Florida have formed an association, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, to organize for better conditions and better prices for their tomatoes. They've won a lot of victories. They've insisted that they should get a penny a pound more for the tomatoes they pick and that labor conditions should be better. Their most recent targets are public supermarkets in the South, in Florida in particular, and Trader Joe's, which so far has refused to sign the agreements with the Immokalee workers. Today we will bring you from the streets of Brooklyn and in front of Trader Joe's the voices of the Immokalee workers and others protesting the fact that Trader Joe's has been recalcitrant and has yet to agree to the penny a pound. That's true of Trader Joe's here in Brooklyn and across the country. I'm Michael Ratner, and my son Jake Ratner actually works in Immokalee, Florida, with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. Because of his involvement, every day, every week, and every month, I learn more and more about the fight for fair prices and fair labor conditions for those workers who pick our tomatoes.
I've been working in Immokalee for the past 11 years. Before that, I was in Central Florida for a little bit. And I've been a farm worker since I was a kid.
And today we're standing in front of Trader Joe's in Brooklyn. And why are we here?
We are here because there's a group and several organizations that are supporting the efforts of this group, which is an ally organization of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. It's the CFA, Community Farm Worker Alliance. And they are asking Trader Joe's to sit at the table with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers to sign an agreement. In this agreement, we are, as the CIW, the coalition, we're asking Trader Joe's to, one, pay a penny more per pound that would be translated into an increase that would be distributed among workers who pick the tomatoes that they are selling in their stores nationwide. The second demand is the establishment of a code of conduct, which is already in place, but needs the reinforcement of the supermarket industry. Basically, committing to buy under the same standards as other 9 corporations have done so far. And the third demand is for them to sit at the table with us, and we need to work this together. So we want the voice of our community included in the process, in the establishment and the monitoring of everything.
Now, you've been in the struggle a long time, and I know you've won the struggle against Taco Bell, which does pay a penny a pound more. Mm-hmm. Now, why doesn't Trader Joe's, which claims to be ethical, and people here, we're in Brooklyn, we're in sort of part of Brooklyn where everybody says, oh, I love Trader Joe's, why isn't Trader Joe's paid a penny a pound? It doesn't sound like much. What's going on?
Well, I think that what Trader Joe's is saying with their refusal is that they are a corporation that is okay with getting involved in fair trade and like this idea of being a green corporation and selling like chocolate that's labeled as fair trade also. All of this idea goes very well for them in the eyes of the public. But when it comes to real commitment, when workers that are at the very bottom of the supply chain stand up and say, you know what, this is the time to create a food system that is fair from the bottom to the top, that includes the workers and their voices on the process, and that can be the model for the rest of the industry. When the workers themselves are asking Trader Joe's to be part of something that is already in place, they refuse to do that. And I think the message they are sending is that they are okay with this as long as it is only a PR for them. But it is not okay for them to actually sit at the table in front of a real solution to the problems that our society is confronting.
Farm workers make very little money right now. I think the number I remember is about $11,000 a year when they pick in Florida. Is that right?
Yeah, it's more or less around those numbers. There's an estimate that comes from the Department of Labor that says the workers earn from like 10 to 12,000 a year. But that estimation also takes into account the supervisors and other positions in the farm. So it's actually less than that. I would say 9 to 10,000, which position our community among the less paid communities in the nation.
Now, if you got a penny a pound more, how much more would a farm worker make?
It depends on the amount, the percentage that's being sold under the Fair Food Program, which is how we call it. If Trader Joe's comes on board, it's going to increase, and then we're going to need other buyers from the supermarket industry that are basically being the holdout in all of this situation to do the same in order to increase the penny per pound for every pound that's picked on the state of Florida. That's the goal. And so far, Trader Joe's is, instead of being part of the solution, they have choose to be a blockade on it.
Right. You've been successful against some of the fast food people, but the supermarkets, Trader Joe's, Publix, have not yet been willing to pay a penny a pound. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So far, we have agreements with Taco Bell, Burger King, McDonald's, Subway, even the supermarkets of Whole Foods. And then we have agreements with some of the most important food providers in the nation. Among them is Aramark, Sodexo, Compass Group. Bon Appetit was one of the first to sign. So in total, we have 9 corporations abiding by the codes of conduct, which establish these codes establish the payment of a penny per pound and new rights that are being implemented this season in most of the companies that produce the tomatoes for this corporation.
Okay, now you're here with about 100 people in front of Trader Joe's, and what are you asking people to do? If I'm a shopper at Trader Joe's, what should I do?
Well, first of all, we're asking people to realize that when you buy without asking, when you support corporations that in the public that basically are trying to push back the efforts of workers that have been able to change a little bit, to improve the conditions a little bit in order to eliminate the poverty wages, situations of abuse, but in the most extreme cases, slavery, which is another branch of the work we do. The fight against slavery has brought us to basically work directly in 6 different cases of slavery, assisting another one, which makes 7 in Florida, and later there's been another 2 cases. So in front of all of this, people are sometimes not aware of these conditions. So we're asking people to realize that shopping consciously can have an impact, negative or positive, in front of these egregious abuses. And we're asking people to just understand this and support the campaign.
And how do they do that? Is there a website they can go to?
Yeah, they can visit our website. There's a lot of information about basically the campaign for fair food, the campaign against slavery, and there's a lot of information to read. The website is ciw-online.org. And people can also call our office, same thing, the information is on the website. And I would just ask people to take a moment to realize that they are, at the end, the ones who have the last word in all of this. What we're asking is simple: to be able to feed our families with dignity, and to be able to eliminate the abuses that continue to exist in the agricultural system. And we can do it. We've been able to bring 9 corporations. We need to bring Trader Joe's on board. And as I said, like, they would listen as long as people are in our side asking for the same thing. We believe that it is our right to ask for this from everybody, because we are the ones providing the food in every family in this nation. So we want to have the same ability for our own. We have a letter in our website that people can print and bring and ask the managers to deliver it to corporate. And we also have some postcards. If people send us an email at workers@ciw-online.org, we'll send you information, we'll send you videos, we'll send you a lot of stuff in order for you to get more familiar with the campaign. And we're basically asking people to do that, to send letters, to send postcards, to be ready, because if Trader Joe's doesn't respond, we might have to do something different. We don't want to elevate the pressure to the point where we ask people to don't buy at Trader Joe's, but that's something that we have used in the past. Trader Joe's needs to realize that it is time. It is time for them to stand up and do the right thing.
Can you explain what's going on here today?
Yes. We're marching to demand Trader Joe's pay a fair share of the slave-like conditions that workers that pick the tomatoes for Trader Joe's are suffering in Florida. We have been asking them for the last 2 years, to sign in as some other corporations have signed, like Taco Bell, Sodexo, which are very, very large corporations. There's around 8 or 10 of those. So that's why we're here. Sorry, my voice is a little broken, but that's why we're here. We're here to demand Trader Joe's signing the agreement for fair wages by just adding 1 penny per pound of tomatoes they pick.
And why is that important?
It's important because it would double their salaries. Each bucket has 32 pounds of tomatoes in them. So if you add 1 more cent per pound, they will receive 32 cents more. So they will increase their salaries dramatically, just bring in fairness to their work.
And why has Trader Joe's said that they wouldn't do it? Can you explain the status of?
That's a very good question, because to this point we don't understand why they don't want to sign in. Taco Bell, McDonald's, very large corporations have agreed to do it, but Trader Joe's has refused to do it, and it's very, very. I don't understand.
Okay. And what's your role? Why are you here?
I'm a supporter of the CIW. Actually working in New York for New York Communities for Change, but I really like the work that they do, and it's very important that we win this battle.
Everything that's happening right now, just like the government and politicians talking about, how they're basically taking away the rights of workers, to unionize. And this is basically just a symptom of what's been happening in general. So that's why it's important now to hear about it. Yeah.
One, 4 farm workers, 1. We are the people, 2. A little bit louder, 3.
I'm not very involved in this. I'm just here in solidarity with the workers that are looking for justice.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
blocks from occupied Wall Street in Lower Manhattan sits the Lower Manhattan Security Coordination Center. You may ask what that is, but what it is a nasty piece of business. Recently uncovered documents show that $150 million of our taxpayer dollars are funding around-the-clock surveillance security center right on top of occupied Wall Street. At that security center, people from Wall Street firms and the New York PD, the New York Police Department, sit right next to each other. High-paid Wall Street workers are sitting next to workers from the Metropolitan Transit Authority, the New York PD, Port Authority, and others. What do they do with that Lower Manhattan Center? They together monitor 3,000 spy cameras installed in the area. Any individual in that area can be tracked by the color of their clothes, by face recognition systems. The system can also read license plates. In her article, Wall Street Firm Spy on Protesters and Tax-Funded Center, investigative journalist Pam Martins focused on the corrupt alliance of indicted corporate firms merging with the police to spy on law-abiding citizens, all of this funded by our taxpayer money. Her latest article in Counterpunch, titled Financial Giants Put New York City Cops on Their Payroll, exposes how private Wall Street corporations are allowed to order a paid detail of New York City police at an average of $37 per hour. A remarkable conjunction of Wall Street and the cops. Today, we're lucky to be joined by Pam Martins. Pam, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks again for the nice invitation.
Well, all of us in the studio have totally enjoyed reading your recent piece about Wall Street firms spying on protesters and private security guarding the many corporations down there. And I guess our first question is, you yourself worked on Wall Street. In what capacity and how did you all of a sudden become sort of watchdog of this area?
Well, I had the benefit of managing my own client base. So Wall Street did not have the same type of leverage over me that it has over so many of its other workers. About 10 years into my tenure, I started reading about the private justice system Wall Street had set up, where both customers and employees had to waive their rights to the nation's courts in order to participate in Wall Street. Customers had to go into an industry-run private justice system, and the employees also. So I started complaining and advocating against that, started researching some of their other practices. They were self-policing. That was totally corrupt. And then I joined with other groups to protest in the streets, filed a large federal civil rights action, and testified in various venues at the SEC, at the Federal Reserve, against some of these practices.
Let's fast forward up to date, because these practices have, I don't know if degenerated is the right word for it, but you've written beautifully about it in Counterpunch. The headline of one of your recent articles is Wall Street Firms Spy on Protesters in Tax-Funded Center. And when I read that, it really gave me the chill, because when I walk here from my office, as you point out, there's some 3,000 cameras trained on me, 1,000 of which are privately owned, and the other 2,000 that the cops own, and they can tell the color of my clothes. They have going to get face recognition software, and they can track me in real time. Talk about that. What is Wall Street doing in conjunction with the public sector in spying on all of us?
Well, first, let me just back up and say I have started last week my third in this series, and it turns out that the story is much more insidious than I first realized.
Oh, great.
because I've come across a 60 Minutes expose on the counterterrorism unit of the NYPD, and in reviewing the video that's online, at the very end of this piece by 60 Minutes, there is a tour of this facility, the one that I'm talking about, the Lower Manhattan Security Coordination Center, which is jointly operated by Wall Street's potential felons, and the largest law enforcement police force in the country.
So you've got the police department sitting next to Goldman Sachs monitoring the rest of us.
And Citigroup.
That's good.
The two that were just recently charged with massive fraud, creating these derivative products, and then that they knew that they were designed to fail, and then betting against them themselves for profit, not to mention two decades of, you know, similar crimes.
I'm sorry, one second. What's the name of this place where these cops and everybody are sitting? What do you call it?
The name is the Lower Manhattan Security Coordination Center.
And where is it?
They say that it's top secret.
Where is it?
It's actually at 55 Broadway, and I'm not releasing any state secrets here, even though on this 60 Minutes episode, they say, well, this is top secret, its location is top secret. It's been repeatedly reported, which if it really was any, you know, great benefit to the public, one certainly would consider it irresponsible to announce its location.
What's in there? What is it?
Well, it consists of three rows of computer terminals. And two of the rows, to show you how Wall Street tends to dominate anything that it touches.
Dominate and corrupt.
Corrupt and dominate. So two of those rows are dominated by Wall Street firms, the New York Stock Exchange, the Federal Reserve. And only one row has uniformed officers. So I called up the producer of the 60 Minutes piece, and I said, you had to, when you were going through this facility, his name is Robert Anderson. He's been with CBS News for 30 years and producing at 60 Minutes for 20 years. And so I called him and I said, you had to have seen all these people in civilian clothes. Did they tell you, did Ray Kelly, when you interviewed him, tell you that Wall Street firms are in there engaging in spying on the protesters and citizens of Lower Manhattan? And he said, yes, we knew that. And I said, but you didn't report it to the public? I said, you know, the news has been dominated since 2008 with the serial corruption of Wall Street that has brought our country to the largest economic collapse since the Great Depression. How could 60 Minutes not see that as a very material fact to tell the public? And he said to me, this is very telling, he said, you sound like you have an agenda.
you bet we do.
Oh, boy.
I'm thinking to myself, now, just a second, Mr. Anderson, you and I both looked at the same set of facts. We both knew that Wall Street firms were sitting there elbow to elbow with the NYPD. I reported it to the public. You did not. You are corporate-owned. I am not, but you're telling me that I have the agenda.
So what did he say?
He said, I then asked him, I said, well, now that I've brought out some serious issues that the public is very concerned about, would you consider redoing your piece and actually telling the real story that the public would certainly care about? And he said, no, we've already done that piece.
They're all sitting behind these computers, a row of cops, two rows of Wall Street people. But the computers don't actually spy on people. They're just sitting what do they do in that room? What goes on?
The computers absolutely do spy.
So tell us how it works.
Okay. So it's actually 2,000 owned by private entities and 1,000 owned by the police. The private industry is outnumbering 2-1.
You're talking about cameras.
Right. Spy cameras.
CCTV, closed circuit TV. Then the NYPD has used taxpayers' money to have one massive computer that looks at all these other individual feeds. So that mass computer has artificial intelligence. And so it is scanning all of these other feeds coming in from these 3,000 CCTV cameras, and it will zoom in on anything that it detects as problematic. So some of that, of course, we could see as purposeful. You know, if there is a suspicious package left in front of the New York Stock Exchange, that sort of thing. But none of the good benefits, the potentially good benefits, require Wall Street participation. There is absolutely no explanation for why Wall Street firms get to sit there and have access to confidential databases that belong to the NYPD. And they're also using in that facility license plate readers. And they have acknowledged that they are able to retain that information of every license plate coming in and out of New York City for 5 years. They're storing that information.
Pam, one of the problems, Pam, with what you've just described, and in case listeners aren't aware, we need to point this out, is that there has been an increased cooperation between the private sector and public law enforcement around the country, especially vis-a-vis the surveillance of protesters. And one of the problems with this is lack of accountability. Private law firms can gather this information and track the whereabouts of protesters, say, 10 months before the upcoming RNC, but they're not bound by the Constitution the way the police are, and that presents a host of issues.
Well, that's exactly correct. And the NYPD did announce in February of this year that they are using facial recognition technology. The guidelines, the privacy guidelines that this Lower Manhattan Center published said they would not use them. But because this facility has declined all of the requests for details from the NYCLU, and I also filed. I have two pending FOIL, Freedom of Information Law requests with the NYPD, and I'm being stymied as well for a lot more details. The fact that they will not release many details, the NYCLU has litigated for years on this center. So, and that's quite interesting in and of itself, that we are the citizens of a democracy. We are supposed to be able to gain information under, you know, sunshine laws. We can't get anything, and yet every detail about us is being, you know, is under surveillance. We're being spied on without our awareness. And back to those cameras one second again. They can zoom in. So let's say, for example, you were sitting on a park bench and reading a book that might be considered, apolitical. They can see what you're reading. There are some reports that they can even zero in or zoom in and read text messages on your cell phones.
That's frightening.
It's a very powerful operation.
And you know what really gets me? Because I have to walk past it every day. This enormous, brand-new glass Goldman Sachs international headquarters that they built right near where I live. And they built it on our money, and they didn't have to pay any sales taxes for what they bought to stick in it. And part of the deal when they extracted our money to build their headquarters was that our money would go into building this surveillance headquarters that they would get to partly staff.
Well, that's correct. And by the way, those sales tax abatements, Goldman Sachs has those in force until 2028.
Oh, great. Meaning what? What does that mean?
For their tenants. So, for example, if a tenant moves in and wants all kinds of remodeling done, until 2028, Goldman Sachs gets to take care of that remodeling to get a new tenant in there without paying any sales tax on what it purchases. But that's actually how this whole thing started to get underway. Goldman Sachs, after 2001, of course, Lower Manhattan was decimated, and a lot of the Wall Street firms were moving uptown or threatening to move to New Jersey. And Wall Street has a very long history of using any kind of leverage to extract every possible concession. And so Goldman Sachs put that in as a requirement. That by December 31 of 2009, if it did not have its seat at what I call the spy center, that it could just kill this whole deal. It could walk away from this whole deal for a very small penalty. It's small in terms of Goldman Sachs' bankroll. And so I guess I'm surmising here, but not that much surmising, because Ray Kelly has mentioned this in many press releases, that they decided that anybody who maintained a large presence downtown would become a stakeholder. And so Wall Street, he uses the term partners. So these Wall Street firms that have committed crime after crime after crime, they're currently under 51 separate state and federal investigations for securities fraud and, you know, essentially looting the public. They're the partners. The potential felons are the partners with the law enforcement authority of New York City. And that is frightening, and that it is not frightening to 60 Minutes. It's not even worth a mention on the 60 Minutes episode is further frightening, and it's I think further example of this incredible seduction power that Wall Street has. It's getting its own private justice system. There is a famous Supreme Court case of a few years ago called Credit Suisse versus Billings, where they got the U.S. Supreme Court to say they, Wall Street firms, are allowed to collude among each other. They cannot be held legally responsible for doing that.
Pam, speaking of seduction, it seems pretty clear that Wall Street is in bed with the NYPD. And you mentioned in another article the paid detail unit of the NYPD that was created under the Giuliani administration, whereby in the NYPD's budget, they've allocated several million dollars for essentially police to moonlight for private corporations. Can you talk about that briefly?
Yes, and it was a somewhat divine intervention that I happen to have a big file on this matter. When I started looking at the videos of the brutality against the protesters at Occupy Wall Street, I kept seeing these white-shirted inspectors wearing inspector badges. And I had this flashback to April 17, 2001, when I was on a public sidewalk in front of Carnegie Hall. Now, this is just another example. Citigroup, that we have just, the American taxpayers, bailed out to the tune of $2 trillion in loans and guarantees because of its internal corruption. Citigroup, for a long time, has held its annual shareholders meeting at a publicly funded institution, Carnegie Hall, in Manhattan.
Oh, that's good to hear.
Yes. So April 17, 2001, I was there on that public sidewalk, where we've had many protests. Myself and other groups have protested on that exact sidewalk. For example, the Vienna Philharmonic would not hire women, so I was there protesting against that practice. We never had any dispute with the NYPD before that was a public sidewalk. But on this occasion, because it was Citigroup, and this white-shirted inspector, his name was Callahan, but he would not give his first name, and he ordered my arrest. Out of 20 different protesters, he seemed to zero in on me. And I think, to this day, that he somehow determined that I might be some type of leader, and it's always a good idea to get the leader out of the way. So I was thrown into jail. Later, I learned that as soon as my pesky presence was removed from the sidewalk, the limousines, the big, long, black limousines pulled up, and out came former President Gerald Ford, who at that time served on the board of directors of Citigroup. Out of a limousine comes Robert Rubin, the former Treasury Secretary of the U.S. He's on the board of Citigroup. Out comes John Deutsch, the former CIA director. He's on the board of Citigroup. So I was removed from a public sidewalk, peacefully handing out flyers alerting to internal corruption at the firm, so that what essentially looks like a shadow government could go and be peacefully escorted into the shareholders meeting in a publicly funded facility of Carnegie Hall. So I never forgot about that Inspector Callahan ordering my arrest. And when I saw all these white shirts beating up on protesters, hitting them with batons, kicking them in the face, I looked to see if this paid detail was still alive. Back in 2001, I had actually found it had a website. Now, that website has been removed, But I did a lot of research and found out that Lehman Brothers owed money to 21 of these policemen when they went bankrupt. I found out that Goldman Sachs was using them, Citigroup was using them. So that's basically just another way that Wall Street has co-opted, you know, public services.
Related to that is if one of these detail officers does something wrong and there's a lawsuit, isn't it the taxpayers who pay for that?
That's correct.
So we train them, we outfit them, and then they beat somebody up, and then then we have to defend their lawsuit.
That's right. They're, the firms that are employing them are completely indemnified. The city will take, and the city has. There have been lawsuits, and the city has paid those lawsuits and paid the settlements for them.
Pam Martins, you are really a genius when it comes to keeping your eagle eye on Wall Street, and we're very grateful to have you on Law & Disorder. Will you make me one promise? Will you come back and be our guest again?
I'd very much love to, and I must say, I'm far from a genius. I just have good filing systems.
Who should know that just down the street from where we go every day, Occupied Wall Street, is this place that coordinates every camera in the area and does worse.
Well, Pam, you've helped bring this to the attention of so many people, and this really augments our understanding of the dynamics between big business.
I thank each of you. I'm very familiar with the work that each of you do.
Thanks, Pam.
Take it easy.
Talk to you soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law & Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law & Disorder Radio on Facebook. Thank you.